afternoon, Met fans, and welcome to another edition of the Terry Collins Show. I'm John Arezzi. We're back for another great week here at the show. We want to thank you, first of all, for all the great response, the views on YouTube, the downloads on all the podcast platforms, all the wonderful interaction on social media. And it all leads back to the man the show's named after. Let's bring on former Mets skipper, current analyst for Baseball Night in New York, Terry Collins. Terry, how you doing?
I'm going great, John. Good to be back. Good to have another show, and looking forward to our show today.
Yeah, we got a great show today. Very special guest, Terry. You got a true legend in Mets history on with us this week. 45 years and running, working for the Mets organization, Jay Horowitz.
Yeah, I'm so excited to have Jay on. You know, when you and I talked about doing this podcast, the first guy I called was Jay Horowitz. I said, listen, I know you do podcasts. Tell me about it. You know, is it something I should look into? Should I not? And he, as he always is, gives me the greatest advice. You know, he's been a great, great friend. And I will tell you, John, which I'm sure we'll talk about when we talk to Jay, I mean, how this guy helped me when I first got to New York. And, you know, I hadn't managed in a long time in the major leagues. And coming to a city like New York and having this man sit me down and explain to me what the process about dealing with the media in New York, because it's huge and it's a big part of managing in New York. And no, I couldn't have had a better mentor than this man.
Well, we look forward to Jay coming on, and that's coming up shortly here. But before we do get to Jay, Terry, let's lead it off by talking about the Mets series against the Braves. The Mets won 2 of 3. There was a rain out there in between, but they won the opener 8-7, dropped the second game 6-5, but they showed life at the end of that game. They didn't give up. They showed a lot of heart. And then the rout of Atlanta 16-4 in the finale. Overall, a big series win for the Mets.
Yeah, you know, I know they started out 0-5, and of course, you know, as we know in New York, the sky's falling when you're 0-5. But you know, it's a huge marathon, and we knew their lineup was too good not to start hitting. And I think, you know, again, as they start getting used to playing every day, and you know, the weather's going to get a little nicer, the offense is going to pick up. You know, the 16-4 game, hey, look, the Braves showed you the importance of having quality starting pitching. You're talking about a team that's lost, you know, maybe arguably one of the best pitchers, if not the best pitcher in the National League, in Spencer Strider. And then you've got Max Fried, who's another outstanding pitcher who has not pitched very well yet. So they're riding 40-year-old Charlie Morton as their ace in Atlanta. So, you know, there are certain times when you play a team, hey, look, you got to take advantage. Nobody feels sorry for you in the big leagues. So when you're hurt or you're banged up, this is when you beat teams. And, you know, and we all know it's going to happen at some time, you know, this season to all the teams. There's going to be some key injuries here and there. And that's when you're going in there, believe me, you know, there was a couple of years where I go back to 2017. You know, we lost all five of my guys in our rotation at some time that summer. And when, you know what, the other teams, they feasted on us at times. And so I think the Mets, obviously, when they start getting that offense going, because they really do have a really good lineup, you know, and it's going to help that starting pitching, because they're going to have some, you know, runs to work with on the board. And that's a big plus to a ball club.
Yeah, it certainly is. But I think this particular series at this particular time, even though it's early in the season, the Mets have kind of been dominated by the Braves, especially down in Atlanta. I mean, they didn't have a very good record there over the last 3 or 4 years. So does this kind of send a message to not only the Braves and the rest of the National League East, but also the fan base for the Mets, a message that this team has a lot of heart?
Oh, totally.
We're not afraid of any.
No, the series in Cincinnati. I mean, Cincinnati's got one of the best young teams in all of baseball. And, you know, they go in there and they win the series in Cincinnati. And then you go to Atlanta, and, you know, and they get out and they win the tough first game, but they score runs. They come back in game two. You know, obviously they have the rainout, but it sent a message through all of baseball that, hey, all the talk before the season that the New York Mets have a playoff caliber team, they're showing the team, hey, there's some truth to that. And now it's all about making sure you stay consistent, stay healthy, do the things that you do well on a daily basis. They've had a little bit of a shakeup in their bullpen a little bit, but I you know, one thing, all they got to do is figure out how to get to that ninth inning, because that guy in the ninth inning is maybe the best in the game. And so when you get that lead and you can get the ball to Edwin Diaz in the ninth, you're going to win some games.
Yeah, I mean, Diaz, it's so great to have him back, first of all. But let's talk about some of the surprises early on here. I've noticed really an emergence of Brett Beatty. Surprising performance from him. I mean, he just seems like he's walking with a little bit of a swagger. He's made some great defensive plays in the field. He's hitting, clutch hitting. Talk to us about Brett Beatty and what you've seen, the difference from that last year to this year.
Well, you know, I was managing when we, or I guess I had just stepped down the year after when we drafted Brett, and you saw a tremendous athlete. And you know what? In the big leagues, it's all about confidence. It's all about having confidence in your ability, knowing you're good enough. And whoever got to him, who's ever told him, hey, look, you know, you're a major league player. You're the, as he said before, you're the top 30 third basemen in all in the entire world. So believe in yourself, trust yourself. You know, you've got skills, and there's going to be good nights and there's going to be bad nights. Last year, we had a tough year. And John, you and I have talked about this. I've told you there are two kinds of players in the big leagues. There are the ones who've been humbled and the ones who will be humbled. And Brett Beatty last year got humbled and he learned from it. And that's what makes good players. You can go back to any player that's ever played. I had big conversations one time with Tony Gwynn. He said, Terry, I've been 0 for 15. I've had slumps in my life, not very many, but you know what? You learn from it. And that's where Brett, all of a sudden, he's learning from it. Now he believes in himself. He's gotten so much better defensively. I'm very, very excited to see what he's done there, because I'm a big believer in defense. And especially, you know, whether you have really good pitching or defense can save some of that mediocre pitching by making plays behind guys. And I think with the way Brett's played offensively has really helped him defensively. You know, sometimes it works out the other way. So whether, hey, you're having a bad time at the plate and you go out and you make a couple errors because your thought process is worrying about what you're doing at the plate. Well, it's working the other way. Now this guy's contributing offensively and he's going out and he's saying, hey, look, I can, on both sides of the ball, I can help this ball club.
Yeah. And the guy that really worked closely with him in the offseason was Francisco Lindor.
Can't have a better guy. Can't have a better guy in your corner than one of the best shortstops in the game. I mean, and again, you're talking about, now that's one thing when you know, with Lindor, we've seen in recently, there's been some, he's, you know, some crazy people that have given him some negative press. He hadn't changed, same guy. He doesn't get down. He doesn't get too high. Doesn't get too low. He just, hey, look, he knows it. He knows it's a tough sport. I've said for a long time, John, if the game was easy, we'd be watching everybody else play. It's very, very hard. And you've got to be mentally tough, and you've got to be mentally sane, safe on a daily basis. You can't get down when you're 0 for 4. You strike out with the bases loaded in the game. It's part of it. The greatest players in the game have all done it. And when you can recover from, you know, a negative and turn it into a good streak, you know, where you get hot all of a sudden, it makes you a better player. And I think we've seen some of our young players with the Mets are starting to do that. Brett's done it. We saw last year Alvarez have some really good streaks and some really bad streaks. But for me, I mean, you're looking at now in this lineup, these guys are hitting in the middle of the lineup. And so it just shows you how much they've grown and how much being able to deal with failure, learning how to deal with failure, is helping these guys be better players.
Yeah, Lindor certainly had smiles on his faces, even though he's in a slump right now, and he'll come out of it. There's plenty of hits in that bat this year. Just to see him stay up, stay confident, pat the guys on the back, be a cheerleader in the dugout. He's become one of my favorite players, Lindor has, and I just can't wait to see how the rest of the season unfolds with him. And it starts off at Citi Field this weekend. The Mets have won two series in a row now. They head home for the series. But the big thing is not who they're playing. They're playing the Royals, okay. They're playing the Pirates. But this weekend, the retirement of number 16, Doc Gooden, what a huge tribute to Doc. How big is that for Doc, Terry, and the Mets fans? And give us your personal recollections of your relationship with Doc Gooden.
Well, to start out with, I think it's a tremendous honor for Doc. Tremendous honor. You know, I've been around Doc a long time. I knew him when he was, you know, I think he when he first left the Mets, and I lived in St. Pete, and we used to work out together, and we became very good friends. You know, and I'm aware of his struggles, and so is he. And you know what? He has been recently, he stood up and been accountable for him. And yet, thank the fans for always being in his corner. They know, you know, sometimes these things are tough to beat. Well, Doc's got a lot of support. And I think what Steve and Alex Cohen are doing to retire his number, Darryl's number, is just wonderful. It's wonderful. You know what that does to a guy? It takes your self-confidence, your self-worth, and makes you feel better about yourself. And I think it's going to be something that's really going to help Doc continue his battle, his off-the-field battle that he goes through, that he has, because he is a tremendous human being. And what he's doing off the field with talking to kids about drug issues, going to schools, Darryl, same thing. I mean, it's a huge impact. And I think this is only going to make the Mets a better organization, having those kind of guys. But I will tell you, when I first got to the major leagues as a coach, I had not seen Major League Baseball because I was so busy with your own minor league teams for years. You know, I never saw Doc back in those early years because I had my own teams I had to run. When I got to the big leagues as a coach with the Pirates, we went in to play the Mets, and this was in 1992. We were pretty good. I might even been 1990. We were pretty good. And we went in to play the Mets. And the first night, David Cone pitched and struck out 13 or 14. And I had seen David Cone in the minor leagues coming up in the minor leagues. So I knew he had good stuff. And so I went in Jim Leland's office when the game was over. And I said, that David Cone's got good stuff. And Jim looked at me and he said, you think he's got good stuff? Wait till tomorrow night when you see when Doc Gooden's pitching. That is great stuff. And sure enough, Doc punched out 16 of us. I mean, he ate Bonds up. And Barry, of course, was the MVP that one of those years. So, I mean, that just tells you how great he was. And you know, you look at it, even when he started on the downside, guy pitches a perfect game with the Yankees or no-hitter with the Yankees. I mean, he just – the talent, the ability to go out there and keep yourself in the game, never get too carried away. Docs, I'm so happy for him. I'm very, very excited to see him get his number retired. And I'm great. I know there's a lot of his teammates are coming up for it. And again, another great tribute to who he is. When all of these guys, all of his buddies from 1986, they all know about what's happened off the field, but they're here to support Doc. And I think that's going to send a big message to Doc.
Well, we all congratulate Doc Gooden, and we congratulate the Mets organization for honoring Doc Gooden. What a special moment in Mets history. Well, Terry, that'll wrap up this segment. Now we're going to get to your buddy and a very special Talking with TC. We're going to bring on Jay Horowitz. Now it's time for a very special Talking with TC. Since 1980, our Talking with TC guest has been affiliated with the New York Mets as the head of the Mets Media Relations Department for nearly four decades, and now vice president of alumni relations and the club historian for the Amazons. Our guest is a 2019 recipient of the annual William J. Slocum Jack Lang Award for his service to the game of baseball, and that was awarded by the Baseball Writers Association of America. He probably has more stories than anyone in Mets history, so it's our pleasure to bring on Jay Horowitz.
Thanks for having me. Always good to be reunited with my friend, Mr. Collins.
Hi, Jay. And listen, thanks for coming on the podcast. And
my pleasure, Terry.
We've got a lot of stories to talk about, a lot of things to talk about. So we're excited to get started. Certainly, you know, you meant a lot to me when I first got to New York. You saved me. I mean, you saved me.
Well, I got you fired, though, Terry. Remember that.
Well, you know, you got me started on the right foot with the writers, and you know that's a huge, huge thing in New York. And you know, without your help, I there's no way I would have been able to survive some of the shenanigans those guys do. So I'm really happy to have you on here today. And you know, I think we need to start out. I think one of the great stories, John, about Jay is how when he first got the job. I mean, it's a true story, and if people remember Frank Cashin, the old general manager. So Jay, tell us about your interview to get that the job.
So this is the winter of 1980. I had accepted a job as a stat guy for NBC with Joe Garagiola and Tony Kubek. About 3 days after, I get a call from somebody who says, I'm Jim McGurney from the Mets. I want to offer you a job to be the PR guy with the Mets. Would you want to go to Florida? I said, Harold, this is stupid. Don't fool around with me. I found out it really was Jim McGurney from the Mets. I called him back the next day. So I flew down to Florida. As Terry well knows, I don't have a great sense of direction. I went to the wrong hotel in St. Petersburg. I was supposed to go to the Hyatt. I went to the Edgewater Beach. Took a cab over to the Edgewater Beach. I was late for the interview. Frank Cashin, our GM, was sitting there at a table, his little white tennis short. I reached over and said, Mr. Cashin, I'm sorry I'm late. I reached over and knocked over this huge container of orange juice on his lap. I swear to God. And then it got better after that. I said, he asked me two questions. He said, have you read Brosnan yet? I said, who wrote that Shakespeare? He said, no, dummy, that's Jim Brosnan, the former pitcher. The interview lasted about two more minutes. Going back to the plane, and I went to St. Petersburg Airport. I called my mom, my mother, and said, Mom, there's no way I got this freaking job. And 45 years still later, I don't know how it is. It's not my good looks. I'm still here.
You know, John, and that's just the beginning of it all. That just breaks the cut. You know, there's so many more that are going to come down the pike here. I just think it's Jay. So Jay, you got a big weekend ahead here. How's things going?
Yeah, great. We're retiring Dwight's number on Sunday. Hopefully we get over 30,000, Terry. You know, the weather hasn't been great, but you know, I've been with Dwight since the beginning. You know, the good and the off the field stuff. You know what? He's really trying to turn his life around. He's working with kids, going to hospitals, goes to schools. And, you know, the question I always get with him and Dow, we retired Dow's number June 1st, is should he be in a Hall of Fame? Maybe he should be. You know, what both guys are doing now is maybe more important than a record or a plaque. They're turning your life around and making a difference in the community, which to me is tremendous.
Yeah, I mean, I can't agree with you more. You know, I've known Doc for a long time. You know, I lived in St. Petersburg. I wasn't there when you couldn't get around St. Pete. But, you know, I used to work out with Doc in the wintertime and became very, very good friends. I mean, this is when he was in great shape. He was just, you know, he had gone to the Yankees at that particular time and, you know, worked so hard to get himself ready to keep pitching. And I think he might have even been with Cleveland then. I think he might have been with Cleveland at that time.
That was probably the late 90s.
It was. And I, you know, one of the things I tried to do, you know, when I was managing in Anaheim, we tried to get Doc in a deal with Cleveland. We never got it worked out, but you know, we've been friends forever. And I totally agree. I'm around him a lot right now. And you know what? He's fighting a tremendous battle. You know,
he's got the heart of gold too, Terry. So does Darryl do. They have the heart of gold. They're good with kids, but you know, Doc thought he had blown his chance, you know, in the suspensions, the drug stuff and everything. But, you know, our new ownership, the Cones, wants to retire here and Darryl's number. And for him, it's a chance to say a final goodbye to the Mets fans. That's what means a lot to him. You know, he never thought he'd have the opportunity to address the people at Citi Field and say, thank you for standing behind me.
Yeah, you know, and again, first class guy. I see him a lot down here. I do a lot of all the fantasy camps, you know, in the fall down here, and he's at every one of them. Goes from guy to guy, sits down, talks to him. Goes, you know, at dinner at night, he goes with different guys out to dinner. He really has, you know, he's really working hard to resurrect.
There's no pretense about
him with the Mets.
You know, he has no pretense about him. He's down to earth guy, and you know, he's very humble guy. He's a very shy guy actually too. You know, but so I'm looking forward to a lot of the. About 6 or 7 of the 86 guys are coming back too, and you know Gary Sheffield's coming back, you know his nephew. So we should have a good turnout. Hopefully, we get some good weather and you know get ready to go.
Jay, in those early years when he was up there, did you see anything? Have you ever seen anything like that? What he did on the field?
No, you know the crazy thing, Terry. He did it all with two pitches. He had a fastball and a curve, which they called Uncle Charlie. Now he's a guys with 6, 7, 8 pitches. He had two basic pitches. And, you know, Joe McElhane was our director of scouting back then. And he had a Joe's a former pitcher who came down to two people, Sam Horn, a former Red Sox, guy, supposed to be a 30, 110 guy, or Dwight. And Joe wanted to take a chance on a 17-year-old kid who had gigantic hands. And Joe always told me he never had a ball came out of his hands. But he did it with two pitches. I mean, who does it with two pitches this day and age? You know, when the 2 years he had in 84, when he won 17 games, in 85, he was a Cy Young, winning a triple crown pitching 24-4 and a 1.53 ERA. It's amazing what it did. Shea was electric, guys. I mean, the 19th pitch, it was a happening. It wasn't a game, it was a happening. We got to go see dog pitches. It could be no hitters. It could be a 16 strikeout game, and it was a place to be. And that's why I'm really so glad we're able to honor him this way.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be great. I'm all excited for him. I'm not going to be able to get there. I've talked to Doc a lot, a couple times about coming up, but I know it's going to be such a mob scene. I know there's a lot of 86 Mets guys coming up, so it's just going to be a wonderful day for him. And I wish him all the best in the world. I can't wait to see him when he finally got this behind him and he can slow down a little bit. John, anything for Jay you sat with him when we were down here in Florida.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, absolutely, Jay. Thank you again for coming on. But I want to talk about Doc
My
for
pleasure.
A sec. I first saw Doc pitch in 84. I was on the road in the music business at the time, so there was no streaming. I didn't get a chance to really watch the Mets like I used to previously. But I got to see him pitch. I believe it was against the Cubs, and it was late in the season. And it was a national TV game, and I was absolutely blown away. I'd never seen anything like this guy, the fastball, his poise for such a young guy. And then
Is that the
85,
Keith Moreland game when he got one hit? Was that the game?
Yes, that was a one hitter. And I was like, talk to us about that 84, 85 season. I don't think fans of this era or the past had ever seen two consecutive seasons like Doc Gooden had in 84 and 85. It was just phenomenal.
He just commanded everything, and he got, I don't think his story is ever to be replicated, guy. In 84, he was 19 years old, 19 years old. And in 95, he was 20. So it was always the first pitcher to do this, first pitcher to do that, first pitcher started an all-star game to get this amount of strikeouts in. The pressure he was under, the previous year in 83, he struck out 300 guys at Lynchburg. So we all knew what was coming, but, Davey Johnson had a fight for him to be on a team in 84. Some people wanted to send him back to the minors, and Davey said, no, I want him on the team. So he just had to make up and to do it. I mean, every start was, you didn't know what was going to happen. And, the string of strikeouts and low run game, but the year he had, I think it was, 24-4. 153 ERA, 276 strikeouts. I mean, just remarkable at the age he was. And he had a lot of poise and a lot of pressure. I mean, it was a big help to me back then. The late Mel Stottlemyre was really Doc's pitching coach with Mets and Yankees and his second father. He taught me how to handle the media. We did something with the Dodgers did with Valenzuela. We tried to limit his media stuff to one appearance a week to kind of take some of the pressure off. Mel was always there, guiding me what to do as a resource. And that's one of the unfortunate things about his day. Mel's not going to be there, and his parents, Dwight and Ella Gooden, won't be there. That's a couple of people. And Davey Johnson, unfortunately, is not going to be able to travel because he broke his hip a couple of months ago and he can't get on a plane. But he was just remarkable. The poise at the age is the thing I just remember most, how young he was.
It was unlike anything we'd ever seen before. And of course, when Darryl and Doc were really so prominent superstars in New York in that major media market and that 85 team, 84 team, 85 team, 86 team. It was just magic. It was a magical era for the Mets. And as a PR guy, as the head of media relations, you saw the struggles when they were building that team. How was that to you? How special was it to you when the team came into its own with Davey and the young kids and then that magical 86 season?
Yeah, I remember guys sitting and the team hated it. They initially hated us at the time because we got like six fights that year. Anytime somebody threw at us, somebody was at the mound. Mike Tyson came and visited us that year because he saw all the fights we went to. He came in post a picture with Doc and Daryl. So I remember game six of the World Series. We're losing 5-3, down 3-2. I'm sitting in Davey's office with Keith and Daryl Johnson, one of our coaches. And I'm just trying to figure out, how am I going to explain to the press how a team who won 114 games doesn't win the World Series? And all of a sudden, you know, Gary gets a hit, Mitchell gets a hit, Ray Knight gets a hit, Mookie's at bat. Next day we rally win. It's remarkable. I mean, that team is really close to me because they, you know, I was just out of college. I was younger then, not like an old guy now. And they were nice enough to vote me a full share, which is unheard of, you know, what they did. And so we just a special bond with us all going through that year, what we did. It was really a good thing to be a part of.
I'm sure it was. I was there during the World Series. I was there.
And can I tell you a quick Terry story?
I was going to ask you about your relationship with Terry, so go right ahead.
I got two stories, Terry. So one is, the one thing I admire most about what he did, you know, when Terry took over the team in 2010, right, Terry?
11, I think, yeah.
11. We were not a very good team. We were not a good team. Moved into a new stadium. And one thing which he did, the little thing I still remember today, is that we did the press conferences. He knew the first names of the reporters. You know, and the guy has to go, well, Bob. And that means so much to these guys. And, you know, it's a little thing. When you listen to the interviews on TV, how many players or coaches know the name of the guy they're speaking to? Very few. And little things that mean a lot, especially in this market. And the other thing he used to do, we used to have these, you know, these press conference sessions. And after the thing, but Terry was such a good talker. Hey, can I get 10 minutes with Terry? And the one-on-ones were so important. And especially at a time when our team wasn't good, to cultivate the relationships. And a lot of the way Terry handled the press, the extra time he gave was, to me, was a lot of times not appreciated by the people in our front office. But, you know, after a 20-minute press conference, 10 minutes to the New York Times, 10 minutes to the Daily News, 10 minutes to the Record. But the way he handled the media was really tremendous. It saved us a lot of bad press, you know, till we got good again in 15. And that's the kind of guy he was. He always had a story to tell, not the same story. Another story I got to tell is after, you know, when Johan pitched no-hitter in 12, poor Terry almost had a heart attack. The pitch count in the ninth inning, you know, was 131, 132, 133. So after the game was over, we used to walk to the press conference room and, hey, what to expect. And he was, you know, almost apoplectic. I mean, he was so drained. Was he, you know, he knew the history. We had Seaver, Gooden, David Cohn. No hitters. This is the first one. He left him in there. But he was so drained during that walk and going at the end of that game, going through. And unfortunately, after the game, after that, Johan pitched, I think it was a shutout after that. But the arm falls, kept caught up with him. But Johan had no second regrets about what Terry did. He wanted to do it, and Terry respected his wishes to do it. So that's one of my – I got two more guys. Don't let me forget. That's what I got for
him. Well, John, I'm going to tell you, when I got to New York, Jay had a – he had a put together a booklet where we sat down, and in the booklet was a picture and a description about all the sports writers, all the TV people that deal with the Mets. And we sat there, and he ran down. He said, hey, here's a little something background on this guy. Here's a background on this guy. And so, and he said, you got to get to know these guys. So all of what he's saying, it came from him. I mean, you know.
Well, but you implemented, though, Terry. You implemented.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, you had to figure out a way. And that's one of the things, obviously, after I've left managing the Mets, you know, I've tried to instill in the guys who came behind me is that those times, those 2 or 3 minutes after the press conference, you've got to be able to budget your time. I know you want to get out on
the especially this guys. Market, Terry. Especially,
I'm sorry, Jay.
This market, especially in the New York,
especially market. In New York market. But those guys, they want that 2 minutes or 3 minutes that they want. You know, they have their own. They're writing their own story. They're writing their own slant to something. And you have to respect their job. You have to respect what they go through. You know, they have bosses. They've got editors that they've got to report to. And so I try to tell every manager, listen, you've got to learn how to budget that 15, 20 minutes after that press conference, because you're going to get hammered by three or four guys off to the side. They all want their own 2 minutes. And it all came from Jay telling me, listen, you're going to have to learn how to deal with this stuff. And so, you know, you sit down. There were certain nights where you actually sat down. I would sit down and say, okay. And this is one of the things he did. He had a feel because he was in the press box. So he had a sense of the pulse of the media, what they were going to talk about, the questions they were asked. So I would walk in the press conference when that game was over, having a great idea what questions I was going to ask. So I could almost prepare some answers before I even got in there. And that's the value of having a guy like Jay, you know, having your back in New York.
And, you know, New York is swamped with stuff. So, I mean, so Terry would do 162 press conferences times two for a season, plus like 35 or 36 big training games time two. So, and the years we got to the postseason, it was more. So New York is a special place to play and to manage, guys.
Yeah, I wanted to bring up, you were talking about how all these press conferences and you sitting in the press box getting a pulse of what the beat writers and the reporters are thinking. There was a night, there was a crazy week in July 2015, as everybody knows.
Yes, sir. Yes,
there
sir.
There was one night where there was a shortstop named Wilmer Flores who's out there on the field, and there's Twitter, and there's a report that he was traded to Milwaukee for Carlos Gomez. I want to get both of your perspectives of that night. Jay, from you sitting in that press box, when this is going on, they're talking about it on TV. Terry's in the dugout. He doesn't know what's going on. So kind of relive that night with us on both of your perspectives.
I called Sandy Alden, who was the GM at the time, and he says, we don't have a trade at the time. I'll let you know if we do. But Sandy, the whole free world is reporting we traded to Milwaukee for Carlos Gomez. I know, but it's not the case. Then I think it's towards the latter part of the game. It came out that I forgot who plunked it. Was it one of our other guys who failed the physical? Was it Gomez? I don't remember Terry.
Yeah, it was Gomez.
Who failed the physicals. Who was
it? It was Gomez that had a bad physical report. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I think right before Terry spoke, Sandy addressed the media and said, we have no trade. And I remember I went to Wilmer, who cried during the game. He was on, he cried on the air. And Terry went to get, we have no trade. And I went to Wilmer. I said, Wilmer, what do you want to do? And Wilmer was one of those guys, listen, he never ran away. He said, let's talk about it. So that day, that endeared him to Mets fans for eternity. What followed, which you couldn't write a story about what the next 3 days, what happened after that. Lily, I'll let you go.
Jay. Yeah, well, you know, I've talked about it. And it's, so I'm on the bench, and I can hear some fans. Wilmer was coming up to bat. And so he was going to the on-deck circle, and I heard some fans yelling at him, good luck, Wilmer, you know, thanks for everything, we'll miss you. And I'm thinking, what's going on here? Well, then David Wright, who was off that night, comes up to me in the dugout, and he said, hey, Terry, he's been traded. I said, who? He said, Wilmer. I said, no, he hasn't. He said, I'm telling you, it's all over TV. They're announcing that he's been traded. I said, David, this guy has not been traded. He said, I'm telling you, it's all over everybody. And the fans are now screaming at him and cheering for him. And I said, David, this guy has not been traded. He said, Terry, I'm just telling you, it's being reported. So I turned and I said, David, you see that phone right behind me? He said, yeah. I said, that phone goes to Sandy Alderson. And if Wilmer Flores was traded, that phone would be ringing because I've got to take him out of the game because he doesn't even belong to us anymore. So I said, if that phone's not ringing, he's got to play. Because I was, you know, back then with David, that might have been a time when David was a little banged up. And so, you know, he needed the night off. I didn't have any more infielders. So he goes on the field and guys on the bench are saying, my God, Wilmer's, he's crying. So he comes off the field between innings and I grabbed him and I said, listen, you're not going anywhere. You're a Met. You've got to pull yourself together. I need you right now. I need you to go up there. And I said, Wilmer, if you were traded, I would be told of it because you wouldn't be in the game right now. So if you're okay, got to go back out there. Well, he goes back out the next inning. And when he steps out of the dugout, the fans went crazy. And to where now he's out there. Now the phone rings and it's Sandy. And he says, you got to get him out of the game. I said, has he been traded? He goes, no, but he's crying on the field. I said, What do you want me to do? I'm out of infielders. And so then when the game was over, of course, the press conference that I'm sure you've seen, John and Jay, of course, was at, you know, they were asking me about being traded. I said, for what? For who? I don't know if this guy hasn't been traded. And so it was a crazy night. But the fact that 2 days later, he hit that home run, you could not, if you were a movie writer, you couldn't have put down a better script than what we saw that in those 3 days.
Remember he came across our plate and put his hand on his chest?
Yeah.
You know, I'm a man.
He was pulling on his jersey. It was amazing. Yeah. It was one of the most emotional games that I've ever seen. And what a great way.
He got a single in his first at bat, too. I think he drove it around his first at bat.
But it was tremendous. And, you know, John, as we get into this, I want to get Wilmer on the show when he gets over by the East Coast. You know, I don't want to bother him early in the morning, but he's a special kid. And everybody's so excited that he's still doing well. And, you know, he can always hit. That was the one thing we knew, that he could really swing that bat. So I can't wait to have him on the show and hear his perspective of it all. That'll be something to hear.
I think so. I mean, he's endeared himself to Met fans for life because of what he was, because of 15 years old being signed and just being a part of that 2015 team and what happened to him and then hitting the game-winning home run. What a great story. But I want to start
with
a great kid. But Jay, I mean, and I'll turn it over to Terry after, but I have a question. There's a lot of stories about you out there and they're all
not
wonderful.
True.
They're not true. I mean, there's so many, but I want to go back because on every April 1st, there's a story about a mythical pitcher named Sid Finch. Share with us the story about what could be the most famous April Fool's joke in the history of baseball.
I think it's the best sports prank ever. And you never can do it this day and age, Twitter. So it was, we're right before spring training in St. Petersburg. Brad Cashin called me to his office and said, I got a call from George Plimpton and Mark Mulvey at Sports Illustrated. They had this idea of an April Fool's joke. The Mets would sign this mythical pitcher who played a flute, came to this faraway country over the whatever, you know, Yugoslavia or something. 6'7" guy with 160-mile-an-hour fastball. Are you up for it? I said, guys, this is how I made my living at Fairleigh Dickens for 8 years with all this BS stuff. So April 1st, 1985, story comes out. The first opening paragraph of the story, of the paragraph, this is an April Fool's joke. Nobody picked up on it. So the whole baseball world was askance. I got a call from the sports editor of one of the New York papers. I don't want to give his name out. How the hell could you give this story to Sports Illustrated? We cover you guys on a daily basis. Well, they just got it. You know, Jim Fry, who was our hitting coach at the time, went to the Cubs. I never heard of this guy. Who is he? Jim, I guess you didn't do your homework. That day, we again go back to Mel Stottlemyre. We used to trade at the old Huggins Tango Field under a tent. We held the press conference with Ron Reynolds, one of our catchers. We burnt a hole in his glove and said this was Sid's 130-mile-an-hour curveball. And Mel played, the guys were tuned. We kept it going for a day or two, and finally we found out, and we retired Sid at the end of spring training in Allied Field. We had a retirement ceremony. But you could do this with the age of Twitter. It was great. It was, you know, and the people never picked up on it that the opening paragraph of Sports Illustrated gave it away. This is an April Fool's joke. Nobody ever got that part of it. It was fun. It was great. It was great fun.
You know, John, part of that whole story, because I was in another organization. Of course, you know, we get wind of this guy that is throwing 125 miles an hour, and they only have him throw sides behind the. That's blankets or something so nobody can see this guy. No, they don't want him out there yet. And guys on other teams were buying into it. They're saying, what the, you know, because the Mets always had this tremendous reputation to find great pitching. And everybody said, yeah, I got to see this guy.
He
played the flute.
He was a high school teacher. He was a big gawky guy, a 6'7" guy. He dressed right between Strawberry and George Foster.
Oh, no.
But that was great fun. Great fun.
You know, and John, this is why, You know, one of the things that Jay brought to the clubhouse, which he always did, was his humor, his desire to have fun, to enjoy what he did, because it's a tremendously stress-related job, dealing with all the writers and the owners and everybody else who's calling him. I mean, he's got the video of him doing that, the Harlem Shuffle. I mean, is a classic. You know, we had a room full, all the guys were dressed up, and there's Jay, and he's got to tell you the story, because he's supposed to have a bad leg and isn't supposed to be out there dancing.
That cost me money, guys. So what happened was, the year before, I fell coming out of a hotel by the stadium, and I fractured my ankle. And I was suing the hotel for negligence because it was a pothole. So then, I guess the Harlem Shuffle was a key thing at that time. So I was asked to perform in front of the team. I did such a good job. The meeting, the video got a lot of hits. And my lawyer called. Said, I love the video, but you cost yourself a couple thousand of dollars because the people didn't know you can walk now. So we had some fun, and it cost me money.
Oh, Jay. I heard once that you almost gave Steven Matz a heart attack or something. There was something about sleeping in the office.
Well, what happened was I'm not a good driver, and after a late night game, I used to sleep in a clubhouse. So I had my shirt on, and I slept in one of the couches. And Steven had come in the next morning to throw, and I had just gotten up with my shirt on, time, my underwear showing, my glasses unhinged, and he was screaming. He said, "What's that?" So I gave the young man a little bit of a heart attack. Hey, can I get to one more Terry story before I forget?
Yes. Yeah.
Our Game 5 in the World Series, Kansas City. After 8 innings, we're beating the Royals 2-0. Crowds going crazy. Looking forward to Game 6 and 7 when we got Syndergaard, DeGrom, Syndergaard. We're gonna get which order to pitch. We're gonna take Matt out of the game. Matt says, "I really want to pitch. I can do it." So it didn't work out the way we wanted to. But to this day, Terry never backed off his decision. He felt that Matt deserved it. Two major surgery before he came back and pitched. He wasn't supposed to pitch at all the latter part of the year. He pitched our clinching game in Cincinnati. He really busted his ass to get us through the postseason. You know, beat Chicago, beat the Dodgers, and to this day, getting some flack, but to his man, Terry believed the guy deserved a chance to finish the game. Didn't work out, but Terry didn't back off his principles.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
I mean, what a night that was. I mean, just what emotion that was as well. You guys must have such incredible stories, but, you know, there's always the funny ones, the pranks. Why don't you share some of the favorite pranks that may have been pulled during the Terry Collins era, Jay? And Terry, please feel free to talk about some of your favorite memories.
Well, you know, I will tell you, John, before he gets into it, you know, in earlier years, he was around some guys that were real pranksters. And I'll let him explain them to you, because some of these guys today, I mean, there was not a day go by that this guy didn't have to look over his shoulder to see what the next prank is going to be. So go ahead, Jay, and tell us what.
See, Maddox was just a prank, but I never considered myself a suit. You know, I was usually, you know, like, you know, Jacob DeGrom. Like, I had a pretty good relationship with Jacob. You know, I'm 40 years older than him. So I used to say, Jacob, we did the meeting. It wasn't crazy about David. Jacob's a small kid from a small town in Florida. I still stay in touch with him to this day. Didn't like the attention. So during his first Cy Young year, when he was 9-6, we never got any support from him. I went to him. I said, Jacob, you know, to get people to vote for you, we got to get your story out. The innings pitch, the hits, the innings, whatever. And he said, listen, I'll do all the interview you want, but you got to do something for me. You got to do what I want you to do. So one, I said, we got to interview Ryder X. Said, okay, we have this basketball court in our locker room. You got to make 6 or 7 shots before I do the interview. So the whole team would be watching me. I never made any of the shots. But he wound up doing the interview. The next time he said, okay, I'll do the interview, but you have to go on the field and hit fungos to Steven Matz and myself. I couldn't even hit the ball. But the whole thing is, I would do things like this. I was always, you know, to laugh at myself. I was always accustomed to do that, you know. And the younger guys like John Franco, I had a great relationship with. He taught David Wright what the right thing to do was. David Wright taught DeGrom what the right thing to do was. So the bottom line is, I would always let myself be part to these pranks or things which people would laugh at me. I never considered they were laughing at me and would be laughing with me. But you know, getting along in the locker room was a tough thing to do. You know, the PR guys always got to ask the players, you got to do this, you do that. They got to know you're on their side, you know. And I would do little things like that to let them know I was one of them. And it worked for 38 years, you know.
Jay, I've always wanted to know. It was always amazing to me the patience you had when a game was over, and maybe it was a tough game, and maybe it was a good game, but you knew who those writers wanted to talk to, and some of them didn't want to talk, and yet your patience, your the way you delivered the message, they always end up talk pocket. I mean
Because
that.
I level of trust, Terry, goes down to not always going something from the locker. Could you do this? Do this? They know if I would, you know, I would obviously think if you hit a home run, it's great. But if you make an error, you know, my famous Tim Tuffle story in the '86 World Series, he made an error to cost his game one. He stood up in his locker for two hours explaining about the error. That's why people love Dwight to this day. It's off the field stuff, you know, off the loss, he never ran. And I always try to instill these guys, they have to trust the PR guys, got to have the trust of the players and the team. And once you lose that, you're a dead person. I just try to develop that layer of trust with the guys, what I did through the years. And they trusted me. You know, once they, you know, the PR guys got a tough job. The owners think that the PR guys partial to the players and the media. The media thinks they're partial to the media and the owner. Yeah, it's a circle. You have to, you know, cater to all three, for lack of a better word.
Well,
Well,
you did it better than anybody, my man. You did it better than
I
anybody.
enjoyed
And
it.
that's why every All-Star game, Jay Horowitz is at it, no matter, who was, whether was there was one Met or five Mets there, they always, you were at every All-Star game, the World Series games that we weren't a part of, you were there. So, the way you did your job certainly was recognized throughout baseball. And I just think you're a
Well,
special person to be able to do
you're a
it. And
special friend,
our
Terry.
friendship, I can't thank you enough for everything you did for me. And
No,
it's
it's
we'll
that's
continue it
one
for a
thing I
long
enjoyed
time.
about my job. Meeting guys like you and having friends like you for life is that's what the whole job is about for me, the personal relationships.
Yeah, Jay, you have a wonderful podcast yourself. I mean, this podcast that you do, I like you to explain it to everybody who may not have listened to it because I listen. I mean, you have Jack Fisher on, Butch Husky. I mean, the legends from the past of Mets history that you get to talk to and keep these memories alive. Tell everybody about how that podcast started
When I switched
and just your
jobs in
relationship.
2000, when I switched jobs in 2018, they wanted me to reconnect with our alumni family because I work with most of these guys in the 60s, 70s. So I would call guys who I have a personal relationship, stories to tell. Turk Wendell, John Franco, Daryl Strawberry, Bobby V, Terry, Davey Johnson. It's just not about stats and stuff. And you know, with Butch, we talked about we were number 42. With Jack, you know, this is the 60th anniversary of the opening of Shea Stadium. He's going to be here April 17th. And we play the Pirates the 60 years to the day that he opened Shea Stadium. He's going to throw out a first pitch at Citi Field, which is stuff. It's guys I have a relationship with. And, you know, this year I try to branch out a little bit to go off the beaten path. So I did a podcast with Phil Sims, with Joe Buck, with people like that, to just to, you know, just people I'm comfortable talking to. You know, it's not a, you know, we did 14 home runs this year, just doing stuff that people are comfortable talking with me about. You know, like with Terry, we remember this about, you know, the times we used to ride to the ballpark together every day, you know, and, you know, that's what they did. You know, when people, you know, I joked about Terry leaving, but a PR guy's with the manager from really February till the year, you ride to the park, eat dinners with him. When a guy loses his job and moves on, it's tough. It's part of your family leaving. So, you know, when that's people should understand that You know, losing a job in baseball is a different thing because you're there so much at the ballpark. We used to tell you, we used to leave like 11:30 on the road for a night game, go to the park and, you know, eat lunch. Terry said he used to see me riding a bike, trying to keep my fingers smelt. And after the game, we used to go home. So you're there like 12 hours. It's a long time to be with someone.
I tell you, Jay, I mean, we got an email that I got to read to you. And it's from a gentleman named David Levy. And when we announced that you were going to be appearing on the show, we got an email at the Terry Collins Show at gmail.com. So I had to share it with both you and Terry. This is not much of a question for Jay, but an observation from what I've seen at Mets Fantasy Camp. All the pro coaches at camp and all the active players that are there demonstrate such admiration and respect for Jay. It's a testament to the quality of the man he is. In addition, he's always so engaging with the campers when he's down there and always seems to recognize us at Citi Field with a wave and a hello. From a fan, thank you so very much, Jay. Mazel tov on your longevity with the Mets. May you only know health, happiness, joy, and continued success. And Terry, thank you for all you do as well. I love the podcast. Sincerely, David Levy. So
that's
I had
it
to
means
share
a lot.
That.
That's what it's all about for me, guys. That one letter captures everything. You know, just try to be nice to people and always have a kind word. Answer all your emails, answer all your calls, answer all your texts. That's what I'm about.
Well, you've done it. And I again, from the bottom of my heart, thanks so much for being on the show and being my friend. We got a lot more fun ahead of us here coming up pretty soon.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. It's always a pleasure, guys. And thanks for having me.
Thank you, Jay. We appreciate it.
All right. Well, take care, guys. Thanks,
Jay.
I'll speak to you soon. Speak to you soon.
Just as advertised, Jay Horowitz, great stories. What a great relationship both of you have had. The friendship is evident. Thank you for bringing him on.
You know what, John, when I was going to do this, you know, I said, I've got to have Jay Horowitz on. And you know what? He's got so many stories to tell. I mean, he didn't tell you about some of the pranks that guys used to pull on him. They used to hide in his closet in his room and scare him at night. And, you know, he'd fall asleep on the plane. They'd cut his ties off. I mean, they did all sorts of stuff to him. And you know what? They loved him. These guys would do anything for him. And you heard what kind of a person he is. So I was really, really thrilled that he'd want to be on the show.
Well, it's amazing to have him on there. What great stories. And I think you got somebody lined up for the next episode. Do you want to share it with everybody that's listening and watching?
I do. I'm very, very excited. This guy, I got to meet him when I took over as the minor league director. The field coordinator with the Mets when I first joined him. Ari Dickey got sent down. He was one of the first guys that got sent out of major league camp. And he came to minor league camp, and we had a rule in the minor leagues that you couldn't have facial hair. And R.A. said, well, you know, I said, look, you got to shave. And he said, my kids have never seen me shaving. And made it a game with his kids and made it fun for them. And so when I decided to do this podcast, I said, there's one guy I got to have on. And, you know, of all the several people I want on, here's one guy who, without a question, had one of the greatest years I have ever witnessed. With this funky pitch that he developed himself, he dominated some great, great lineups. The year that R.A. Dickey had when he won the Cy Young, truly one of the great years of anybody that's ever pitched. And he's a special human being. I read his book, stirring book. So I'm excited to have R.A. on next week.
Well, we certainly look forward to that. It's going to be great to bring on R.A. Dickey on the next edition of the Terry Collins Show. Don't forget to follow Terry on social media. Go to @TerryCollins_10 on both X, which is formerly Twitter, and Instagram. There's a fake Facebook page now that we've started for the Terry Collins Show, so look for it there. Terry, your social media is blowing up. I mean, we put up a little clip of you talking about Noah Syndergaard and, you know, what was that? You know, why didn't you hit him? You know, if you want to leave a bruise. And it has been seen now on Instagram in the last 48 hours by over 20,000 people. 20,000 people have played that video. They're sharing it. So if you want to see these little clips, you go to the YouTube channel. You can go to Instagram. You go to Twitter. people are loving the interaction and they're loving your story. So don't forget to follow Terry on all those social media platforms. You'll be very well entertained, and it'll be a way for you to follow what's going on with the show. So, Terry, it's great as always to be with you. And until next week, when we have another show, this is John Arezzi for the Terry Collins Show. Let's go, Mets.